Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Kelly Jean Kelly, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Cairo, Egypt's capital, is one of the largest cities in Africa and one of the best known in the world. For more than 1,000 years, it has stood on the banks of the Nile River, the longest in the world. The pyramids of Giza sit close to the city's southwestern edge. Among the city's tall structures are over 400 historic buildings from the times of the Roman, Arab, and Ottoman empires. The city's center was named a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 1979. The city's Tahrir Square later became known as the birthplace of the Arab Spring movement. Across Cairo, there are large signs telling its 20 million people of new homes being built in the desert 45 kilometers away. Often the signs are in Cairo's overcrowded neighborhoods with poorly built homes and dirt roads filled with untreated human waste. The signs are ways to suggest that government employees, foreign embassies, and rich people will soon leave Cairo for a new capital city in the desert. The new administrative capital, which still does not have an official name, is the idea of former Army General President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. It is the biggest of several huge projects. Others include new roads, housing projects, and the expansion of the Suez Canal. Egyptian officials often compare the projects built under al-Sisi to monuments like the Giza pyramids. Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly said, "History will do justice to this generation of Egyptians, and our grandsons will remember its achievement." But critics call the new capital a vanity project for al-Sisi. They say the money could have been used to help the economy and to rebuild Cairo. Hassan Nafa teaches political science at Cairo University. He said, "Maybe al-Sisi wants to go down in history as the leader who built the new capital. But if Egyptians don't see an improvement in their living conditions and services, he will be remembered as the president who destroyed what is left of the middle class." The government argues that Cairo is too crowded and will grow to 40 million people by 2050. The new city is being built on 69,000 hectares, about two times the size of Cairo, at a cost of $45 billion. The project began in 2016. The first of the expected 6.5 million residents are to move there next year. The city will hold the offices of the president, the cabinet, parliament, and the ministries. City planners promise to build public parks, an airport, an opera house, sports structures, and 20 skyscrapers, including Africa's highest at 345 meters. Matbuli denied that the new capital will only bring wealthy people. However, the smallest apartment, about 120 square meters, in the new city, is expected to cost about $73,000. That price is out of reach for a mid-level government official who makes about $4,800 a year. No one knows how the new capital will affect Cairo. Many government buildings in the city are large homes taken by the socialist governments in the 1950s and 60s. Some fear that the empty buildings will fall into disrepair or be torn down. Sameh Abdallah Al-Layli is an urban planning expert. He said the building of the new capital should be halted. He wrote in the Al-Sharuq newspaper, "Historical Cairo must remain the political capital of Egypt." I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
On Tuesday, the Pew Research Center reported that the number of immigrants staying in the United States without permission fell to a 10-year low in 2016. Researchers used government data to show that from 2007 to 2016, the number of undocumented immigrants dropped from 12.2 million to 10.7 million. Pew linked the decrease to a large reduction in the number of Mexicans crossing the U.S. border illegally. However, the number of immigrants from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras trying to cross over from Mexico illegally was up. Central America is the only region for which there was an increase in undocumented immigrants during the period of the study. Arrests of Central Americans at the U.S.-Mexico border have also risen, but Pew researchers said arrests remained well below their highest number in 2014. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Engineers say they have carried out the first ever flight of an electric airplane with no moving parts. Researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT, recently shared video of the successful test flight. They also reported their results in the scientific journal Nature. An airplane usually requires fast-turning turbines to create the necessary thrust and power to lift the plane off the ground and stay in the air. But MIT researchers say they have created a new air vehicle that powers itself without this kind of engine. In fact, the plane was designed to have no moving parts at all. Engineers say that developing and expanding such technology could greatly change the future of flying. It could lead to the creation of planes that are safer, quieter, and easier to take care of. Such planes would also not produce emissions that harm the environment. Stephen Barrett is a professor of aeronautics at MIT. He helped lead the plane's development. He said the successful tests have opened up new and unexplored possibilities for future aircraft. Barrett says he first got the idea for planes without moving parts from watching Star Trek. He told MIT News he imagined that futuristic air vehicles, such as the ones created for Star Trek, could one day fly in the real world. Such vehicles had simple designs. They moved smoothly and silently. The new technology is based on experiments that date back to at least the 1920s. Those early experiments dealt with a system used to create thrust called ionic wind. Ionic wind describes a wind or thrust that can be produced when electrical current is passed between a thin and thick electrode. If enough electricity is created, the air between the two electrodes can produce enough thrust to power a small aircraft. MIT's experimental plane weighs about 2.5 kilograms. It was made to look similar to traditional aircraft. But instead of having engines attached under the wings, it contains a series of electrodes. The electrodes in the front are made of thin wire. In the back, they take the form of thicker airfoils. The wires in front and airfoils in the back both carry high electricity, up to 20,000 volts each. The two create an electrical field of opposing forces that produce wind behind the plane to make it fly. Barrett said his team dealt with several failed attempts during early test flights of the plane. But the team was finally able to complete a successful flight in which the aircraft traveled about 60 meters in 10 seconds. He added that the plane likely could have flown farther if the test had been carried out in a larger building. Barrett says the experiment demonstrated the first continuous flight of a plane that is heavier than air, but has no moving parts. This was the simplest possible plane we could design that could prove the concept that an ion plane could fly, he said. Although the reported results could mark the beginning of major changes in the field of flight, Barrett said the current technology has shown limitations. It's still some way away from an aircraft that could perform a useful mission, he said. It needs to be more efficient, fly for longer, and fly outside. One possible issue will be creating a battery that is powerful enough to operate much larger versions of such aircraft, without being too heavy to fly on the plane. Barrett says the current limitations make it more likely the technology will first be used to create smaller air vehicles. One possibility would be a drone. Drone use, especially in large cities, is expected to greatly increase around the world in coming years. The MIT team says it believes drone designs without moving parts would create vehicles that are nearly silent and less polluting than current models. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, they wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we talked about the debate at the convention over the Virginia Plan. The plan was prepared by James Madison and other delegates from the state of Virginia. It described a national government with a supreme legislature, executive, and judiciary. Some delegates feared that such a central government would take away power from the states. But in the end, they approved the proposal. On June 1st, they began debate on the issue of a national executive. It seemed every delegate at the Philadelphia Convention had something to say about the issue. They had been thinking about it for some time. Almost every delegate was afraid to give the position extended powers. Almost no one wanted America's chief executive to become as powerful as a king. Still, many of the delegates had faith in the idea of a one-person executive. Others demanded an executive of three people. James Wilson of Pennsylvania argued for a single executive. He said the position required energy and the ability to make decisions quickly. He said these would best be found in one person. Edmund Randolph of Virginia disagreed strongly. He said he considered a one-person executive as the fetus of monarchy. John Dickinson of Delaware said he did not denounce the idea of having a government headed by a king. He said a monarchy was one of the best forms of government in the world. However, in America, he said, a king was out of the question. The debate over the size of the executive leadership lasted a long time. Finally, the delegates voted for a one-person executive. The question of how to limit power was a major part of the delegates' conversation, according to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas.
We're still talking about what are the limits of the national government? What is the role of the national government? How do we protect individual rights and individual liberties, etc.?
And he says that question continues to be asked in America today. During the debate at the convention, other questions about the national executive arose. One question was the executive's term. Should the executive serve just once, or could that person be re-elected? Alexander Hamilton argued for a long term of office. He said, If a president served only a year or two, America soon would have many former presidents. These former presidents, he said, would fight for power, and that would be bad for the peace of the nation. Benjamin Franklin argued for the right of re-election. The people, he said, were the rulers of a republic, and presidents were the servants of the people. If the people wanted to elect the same president again and again, they had the right to do this. In the final document, the president's term was set at 4 years, with re-election permitted. Next came the question of how to choose the president. It was a most difficult problem. The delegates debated and voted, and then re-debated and re-voted on a number of proposals. James Wilson proposed that the executive be elected by special representatives of the people called electors. Several delegates disagreed. They said the plan would be too difficult to carry out and would cost too much money. One delegate proposed that the president be elected by the state governors. He said the governors of large states would have more votes than the governors of small states. Nobody liked this proposal, especially delegates from the small states. Another proposal was to have the president elected directly by the people. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts was shocked by this idea. "The people do not understand these things," he said. "A few dishonest men can easily fool the people." The worst way to choose a president, he said, would be to have him elected by the people. The convention voted on the issue 60 times. In the end, the delegates agreed that the president should be chosen by electors named by state legislatures. Now someone said, "We have decided how to choose the president, but what are we to do if he does bad things after being chosen? We should have some way of dismissing that person." Yes, the delegates agreed, it should be possible to try the president, and if he is found guilty, remove him from office. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania spoke in support of the right of impeachment should the president be persuaded to betray his trust. The delegates approved a proposal for removing a president found guilty of bribery, treason, or other high crimes. The last major question about executive authority was the question of veto power over the national legislature. Not one delegate was willing to give the president complete power to reject new laws, and yet they felt he should have some voice in the lawmaking process. If this were not done, they said, the office of president would have little meaning, and the national legislature would have the power of a dictator. James Madison offered a solution. "The president should have the power to veto a law," Madison said, "but his veto could be overturned if most of the members of the legislature voted to pass the law again." The final convention document listed more details about the office. For example, it said the president had to be a natural-born citizen of the United States or a citizen at the time the Constitution was adopted. The president must have lived in the United States for at least 14 years and be at least 35 years old. The executive would be paid, but the pay could not be increased or reduced during the term in office. The president would be commander-in-chief of the armed forces and, from time to time, report to the legislature on the State of the Union. The final document also gave the words by which a president would be sworn in. Every 4 years, for more than 200 years now, each president has repeated this oath of office. I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Another major issue debated by the convention was a national judiciary, a federal system of courts and judges. The delegates knew a lot about the issue. 34 of them were lawyers. 8 were judges in their home states. One question hung heavy in the air. The states had their own courts and judges. Did the national government need its own system too? Several delegates said no. Roger Sherman of Connecticut said existing state courts were enough. Besides, he said, a system of national courts would be too costly. John Rutledge of South Carolina opposed a national system of lower courts, but he argued for a Supreme Court. Eventually, the convention voted for both. There would be a Supreme Court and a system of lower courts. These courts would hear cases involving national laws, the rights of American citizens, and wrongdoing by foreign citizens in the United States. State courts would continue to hear cases involving state laws. The next question concerned the appointment of national judges. Some delegates believed judges should be appointed by the legislature. Others believed they should be appointed by the president. James Wilson argued in support of having one person appoint judges. He said experience showed that large bodies could not make appointments fairly or openly. John Rutledge disagreed strongly. By no means, he said, should the president appoint judges. He said that method looked too much like monarchy. Benjamin Franklin then told a funny little story. In Scotland, he said, he understood that judges were appointed by lawyers. They always chose the very best lawyer to be a judge. Then they divided that person's cases among themselves. The delegates voted on the issue. They agreed that the legislature could decide how many judges would sit on the Supreme Court. The president would appoint the judges. The legislature could establish lower courts from time to time. The president would appoint those judges too. The issues involving the executive and the federal courts were serious questions that most delegates felt strongly about. But the most hotly debated issue of the convention was still to come.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.